Diplomatic sources say that the U.S., U.K., Germany, and France have submitted a draft resolution against Iran's nuclear program to the IAEA Board of Governors. Russia says it's now in full control of residential areas of the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk. Venezuela slams the United States for excluding three South American countries from the Summit of Americas, describing the move as an act of discrimination. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the IAEA to vote down a resolution proposed by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member board. It accuses Iran of failing to offer transparency over unexplained activities at three nuclear sites. But Tehran is warning the agency against politicizing its nuclear program. It says it's fully collaborated with the IAEA in resolving outstanding issues. The foreign ministry has dismissed the move as unconstructive, especially given the Israeli propaganda and support for an anti-Israel, anti-Iran move. Tehran says any such resolution would negatively impact both its cooperation with the agency and the JCPOA revival talks. It's pledged to give a proportionate response to any such move. The British Prime Minister has survived a confidence vote triggered by members of his own party. Boris Johnson has escaped losing his post amid growing calls for him to resign over a raft of issues, including the Partygate scandal. Saeed Purozad reports from London.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
In
this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result, and what it means is that as a government we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
Things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm-twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds. And the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance. So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saeed Purozad, London.
In other news, Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in eastern Ukraine as the war between the two grinds through its fourth month. Moscow says its troops are now in full control of residential areas in Severodonetsk.
The residential areas of the city of Severodonetsk have been fully liberated. We continue to establish control over the city's industrial zone and the nearest settlements.
A fierce fighting is raging on the streets of Severodonetsk, with the mayor saying that the situation is changing every hour. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian troops, but they still have a chance to fight back. He says Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory from Russian forces and that a stalemate is not an option. Zelensky rejected speculations that Ukraine might cede some parts of its territory to Russia to end the war. White supremacists are no longer causing trouble exclusively inside the U.S. American authorities are now concerned about a battle-hardened extremist fighting in Ukraine who are set to return to their homeland. And that's particularly worrying about the rising violent incidents inside the United States.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war. In this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone.
The exact number of American nationals fighting in Ukraine is not known, but a report in March estimated it to be around 3,000. The challenge they pose to Washington is twofold. First, they will return to the U.S. with more military training, which could escalate the country's already alarming rate of domestic terror incidents. And second, they confirm the Russian notion that Moscow is fighting a war against new Nazis and foreign elements.
Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that established beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
Moving on, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has slammed the United States for excluding three South American countries from the Summit of the Americas.
What the U.S. government is doing is an act of discrimination against three peoples, three governments, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
And Maduro says that the exclusion of these countries won't silence their voices and that the U.S. is sabotaging the event, dooming it to failure. Several South and Central American states, including Chile, Cuba, and Mexico, have also blasted Washington's exclusionary move. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responded by boycotting the meeting. He said that the U.S. lacks respect for nations and needs to change its policy of barring some while inviting others. This is the first time that Washington has hosted the event since its inaugural session in 1994. The U.S. intends to boost its regional leadership through economic collaboration, among other issues. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. China accusing Australia and Canada of spreading disinformation, and that after two countries blamed Chinese military pilots for dangerous maneuvers in international airspace. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Beijing resolutely opposes actions that threaten sovereignty and security under any pretext. Zhao Lijian was responding to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's comments a day earlier. Trudeau accused Beijing of harassing its aircraft during patrols to monitor UN sanctions on North Korea last month. China said that the UN Security Council has never authorized any country to perform military surveillance in other countries in the name of enforcing sanctions. Meanwhile, Lijian also reacted to Australia, accusing China of intercepting its spy plane over the South China Sea.
The Australian side has turned black into white, repeatedly has spread false information and advocated confrontation. China expresses firm opposition to this. We urge the Australian side to immediately stop such dangerous and provocative actions and to strictly restrict the actions of its naval and air forces. Otherwise, it will bear all serious consequences arising therefrom.
The Legion added that the Australian aircraft ignored repeated warnings and continued to approach Chinese airspace. It stressed that the Chinese military has always conducted operations in a safe, standard, and professional way in line with international law. Australia argues it's not unusual for it to undertake surveillance flights over the South China Sea. But China says that pilots took reasonable but forceful measures in response to provocative behavior. Pakistan has summoned the acting Indian ambassador to record a strong protest over derogatory comments made by two Indian ruling party members against the Prophet Muhammad. People are also reacting angrily, calling for a united stance against the deliberate campaign to malign the religious personalities of Islam. Kamran Yusuf reports from Islamabad.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
We condemn this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims.
Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Well, that's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Today, the success in the face of heavy odds of the anti-terrorism organizations such as Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Ansarullah, Hashd al-Sha'bi and others is ample proof that Imam Khomeini's enlightening message can never be extinguished by the imperialists of the West or by the Zionists and the unelected Arab reactionary regimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading "The Spectacular Spread of the Islamic Revolution." Stay tuned, please. They keep coming in hundreds of thousands, if not in millions, to pay homage to the memory of the man who delivered the nation from domestic despotism and foreign hegemony. Neither the vicissitudes of weather prevents them from paying respects at the mausoleum of the sage of the age who changed international equations, nor does the poisonous propaganda of the enemies dampens their devotion to the timeless values of Islam that he revived. On Saturday, June 3rd, multitudes of men, women and children, including the elderly, on wheelchairs and the infants in perambulators, converged in Tehran from all over the country, several from abroad as well, to commemorate the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Following end of the 2-year-long coronavirus pandemic, the Iranian masses, who a month and a half earlier had come out in millions throughout the country on the farewell Friday of fasting Ramadan, designated Rul Quds Day by Imam Khomeini, to reaffirm their resolve to liberate Palestine from the tentacles of the Zionism, once again gave a grand public display of their dedication to the ideals of the father of the Islamic Revolution. This explains the sheer frustration of the enemies of Iran and the Iranian people in their feverish plots of the past 42 years to undermine the Islamic Republic. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, pointed out in his speech at Imam Khomeini's mausoleum the day before yesterday, the blundering enemies led by the U.S., blinded by their ignorance of the realities in Iran, have continued their miscalculations. In other words, the Americans and their stooges, who live in a false paradise, have axed their own feet by dreaming to undermine and overthrow the grassroots-supported Islamic Republic system of government. As a matter of fact, their dreams have turned into nightmares, as is clear, not just by the peace, progress, and prosperity the Islamic Republic of Iran enjoys due to public support, but also by the positive impact of the Islamic Revolution on the people of the region. This is evident by the emergence of popular mobilization movements in Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Bahrain, and other countries of the neighborhood. Today, the success in the face of heavy odds of the anti-terrorism organizations such as Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Ansarullah, Hashd al-Sha'bi, and others is ample proof that Imam Khomeini's enlightening message can never be extinguished by the imperialists of the West or by the Zionists and the unelected Arab reactionary regimes. Tomorrow, the people of Bahrain will definitely join the ranks of nations freed from the yoke of repression, and soon it will be the turn of the Egyptians and other Arabs groaning under the sandals of the clannish and cultish regimes. While our foes fear this as the export of the Islamic Revolution, our friends welcome it as a spread of Imam Khomeini's enlightening ideals.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing India in a changing global geostrategic environment in a conversation with author and former ambassador M.K. Bhadrakumar. But first, this brief analysis.
In the wake of the Western sanctions on Russia, pressure was applied on India to join these sanctions, which India, like most other non-Western nations, refused to join. India insisted on maintaining its decades-old strategic relation with Russia and the former Soviet Union as it relates to energy and food imports, but particularly as it relates to India's military, which has traditionally used a large percentage of Russian-made hardware and technology. This refusal resulted in the West sending UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to India in order to offer military hardware contracts as an alternative to the Russian strategic relation. In general, the US and the West are pursuing a strategy of using India as a wedge against Asian and Eurasian integration by stoking tensions between India and China and India and Pakistan. Given its size and power, India insists on its strategic independence, and while, for example, it is a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it is also a member of the US-led Quad Group, along with Japan and Australia. As the US keeps raising tensions and stoking conflicts, it's questionable whether it's possible for countries such as India to maintain such a balance between the West and the rest without having to, at some point, choose a side. Like all countries, India too is faced with a rapidly changing geostrategic environment. Since the 19th century, the West's strategy in Eurasia has been to cause conflict and destabilization, in order to prevent Asian nations from becoming global powers, and in order to prevent a strategic alignment between Asian nations against Western imperialism and neo-imperialism. In this environment, the US and its vassals will use every dirty trick to cause conflict between India and its Asian neighbors, and will use every dirty trick to destabilize India domestically in pursuit of the West's goal of strategic domination of Eurasia. This is the challenge facing Indian elites, as they have to resolve India's strategic challenges, particularly its relationship with China and its significant domestic socio-economic underdevelopment, so that India does not become a second Ukraine sacrificed by the United States and the West in its strategic conflict with China, Russia, and other rising Asian powers. It seems that India has enough elites who are familiar with the real character of Western nations, and who have not forgotten the injustices perpetrated upon the Indian people by Western imperialism. On the other hand, there are also those elites in India who are desperately seeking to maintain their good standing with Western security and financial elites, and their personal and family contacts and residencies in Western capitals and cities, who would be willing to offer India as a platform for Western strategic infiltration into Asia. Undoubtedly, India will be a global superpower in the future if it is capable of resolving its domestic and international challenges without succumbing to the temptation of becoming a pawn of the West in return for money and privileges offered by the Western oligarchy to Indian elites, similar to what we have witnessed in countries smaller and less powerful than India, and which ultimately led to the ruin and bankruptcy of those countries.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You know, when we started the program, it's a new show, it's a new program that we started. One of the first topics that we decided that we're going to do was India, because of India's importance in terms of the geostrategic situation that exists in the world, and being one of the largest countries and one of the most populous countries, and all the reasons that everybody knows as to the importance of India. And of course, the first person we thought of doing the interview with and the conversation with was you, because people can follow you on indiapunchline.com, and you're also a columnist for The Cradle, where you have very interesting articles. I always benefit from reading your articles. They're insightful, and they're also very entertaining as well, which is a rare combination. So I really recommend to go check out your writings on these platforms that I mentioned. So with that, Mr. Ambassador, I want to get straight into it. In terms of India, it's very interesting because we see that there is a strategic realignment happening in the world. Of course, all of this accelerated by the war in Ukraine. It's very interesting. Zbigniew Brzezinski, before he passed away and before he, when he wrote in his last book, he said the worst case scenario for the United States is an alignment between China, Russia, and Iran. And interestingly, he didn't mention India really in this issue, which you know, I think has its reasons why he didn't mention this. So we have this strategic realignment, and we see that immediately the West begins to work on India to prevent India from entering into this larger Eurasian integration. Maybe they are not capable of completely preventing it, but they want to hedge their bets with India, having a large, powerful country in Asia, which is able to be used as a wedge, as a balance, whatever word you want to use, whatever concept you want to use, in this emerging Eurasian geostrategic alignment, which, as a person like Zbigniew Brzezinski, which is considered one of the leading geostrategists of the West, called the worst-case scenario for the West. So we saw recently that in the Ukraine war, there was a lot of pressure for India to join the sanctions, and very clearly India rejected that. Both the foreign minister and things that were stated by the Indians in terms of their a long history with Russia, even going back to the time of the Soviet Union, in terms of the military relations that they have and the military in India. And then what happened, very interestingly, is that immediately you see Boris Johnson, you know, flying into India, talking about, you know, long-term strategic contracts in terms of the military and weaning the Indians away from their dependence on Russia. We have the European Union talking about these things. The thing that I find interesting, or the thing that maybe we should talk about, is this. I believe that India sees itself as powerful enough in order to be able to balance these events. That on the one hand, it is in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but it is also in the Quad. On the one hand, it has these strong relations with Russia, but on the other hand, it has these strong relations with the West, whether it's the U.S. or England. You know, in a lot of West Asia, there's a funny expression. They say somebody trying to dance at two weddings at the same time. It seems that India feels that it is powerful and important enough to be able to do this straddle, this bridge, this gap. And from some of the writings that I read, that you've written from some of your writings, it seems to me that you believe that maybe this is not something that can be straddled and can be achieved in the long run for India. That at some point India has to make a choice, whether it is with the West or the rest, as you called it. You talked about India having a lot of straw men in one of your articles, about there being an elite in India that is very much, you know, susceptible to corruption, maybe, from certain forces, whether it's the West coming in and trying to, you know, as we've seen in many countries, this is not specific to India, but a lot of countries, you see elites desiring to be part of this Western elite, and so in that way, the West comes in and does certain things. So with all this, big biryani rice that I just gave you in terms of everything being mixed together, can you please give us some insight into this, what's going to happen with India and in this strategic realignment that's happening in the world today?
You see, well, I broadly agree with your reading of the situation. I would only qualify this way, right at the beginning, that there are different templates here from the Indian perspective that cannot be overlooked. You know, the alignment, the Eurasian alignment, is an esoteric concept. But what I am mentioning are very tangible, practical level, which are of very important concern for India. First is, in the present situation, if you dissect the present situation, you're right, India has come under immense pressure from the Western world. But why India is taking a position like this is not so much as a desire to balance, but in terms of asserting its strategic autonomy. Mm-hmm. And that autonomy is important for India from two, three different angles. First and foremost, there is this aspect of India's national policies. Now, national policies are, as in most countries in the developing world, they are in regard of development, economic growth development, and they need to be sustained. And during this period of the pandemic, they have taken a heavy beating, you know, these policies and these. There's been a serious setback. Our central bank, called the Reserve Bank of India, only last week came out with an assessment that it will be not before 2034, 2035, that India will be able to recover from the damages caused by the pandemic. So you can imagine there is a criticality about this period of time ahead. The next 10 to 15 year period, the corridor of time. Much as we are all glued to the Ukraine crisis, I'm only underscoring that India has its own concerns and its own national priorities. And I, for one, will firmly endorse the view that a good foreign policy is a reflection of the national policy. That is point number one. Therefore, you know, whatever stance we are adopting are primarily in a defensive way, in the sense that we don't want to get damaged collaterally or otherwise. You know the famous African proverb saying that when elephants clash, it is the grass on the ground that suffers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this kind of thing can happen. And India is a is aspiring to be a globalized power. And what happens in other parts of the world are certainly going to impact Indian interests. This is the first one. The second template, which is equally important, in a way, from the strategic perspective, the most important consideration is that Russia is not like any other power for India. Russia has been an anchor sheet for Indian strategies for close to some 60, 70 years, which is for a country 75 years of independence. Is a long, long period of time, almost from its childhood.
Exactly.
So you see, through the entire period of adulthood, India has viewed Russia in a certain way. India has experienced the understanding and support that Russia has shown toward India. And whoever may say anything else, you know, we are not in the habit of dumping our friends. Exactly. We are not in the habit of switching sides. India never did that, you know. You look at the whole history of Indian diplomacy. It has been, there is always a consistency. Once a situation arises and the country takes a principled stance, it has derived the principles behind it. And it is clear-headed about it. And it pursues that. Of course, there would be ups and downs. And there are certain periods of time when India cannot be optimal because of its own, you know, limitations in a situation. But broadly, the compass is set. That is the second point. And here, you know, the tangible factors are, this is a very important relationship even today for India. One is estimations vary, but some people say even up to 60%, 70% of the weaponry, for example, used in the Indian Armed Forces are of Russian origin. And it's an important contributor to India's defense capability. And it's not only that in terms of, in quantitative terms, it is also in qualitative terms. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a well-known thing that the Western world, much as we can diversify our sourcing of weaponry, mm-hmm. and many Western countries, and there's no embargo against India. But, you know, Western countries and particularly the Americans are almost always reluctant about parting with really modern advanced technology, technology transfer. Yes. They want to just sell and they want to keep the software in their hands.
Exactly.
Because it is also geopolitically important that, you know, India does things the way they want in any given situation involving military or coercive use of power. You know, the fact is it is only Russia which has almost always given almost anything that India asks for in terms of very advanced cutting edge military technology that it is readily given. And India has an old program which is struggling to take off that is about building up a defense industry. Mm-hmm. You know, it will be very, very incredible it may sound to you, but our defense industry is not as good as yours, for example, in Iran's. We would like to go on.
You should have been sanctioned. That would have helped, I think.
We would actually like to go on the same track. You know, you've done fantastically well in building up an indigenous capability. India wants to go on that track.
Yes.
And it is only Russia which has, you know, been helping us in terms of co-production, designing, and all kinds of work like this. Otherwise, the others, you know, they just want us to buy off the shelf. And they make good money on it, and then they just go in a different direction. So all these considerations are there. Then in political terms also, you know, it's a veto-holding power in the United Nations. Exactly. And I cannot recollect a single instance where an Indian national interest is involved. Russia has not helped India. Exactly. You know, whatever might be its reservations, even then it has been forthcoming with support for India. I'm not speaking just about Kashmir. You know, the kind of level of understanding is, it's all pervasive. So you see, this is the second template. And, you know, the third template is, you know, that initially there is a certain kind of labeling that this thing unfolding in Ukraine is about democracy versus autocracy. But, you know, we have a very competent foreign policy establishment, and they could see through it and understand what is the ultimate Western objective, which is to weaken and, if possible, destroy in Russia. Now, it's unthinkable that India can be a party to such a conspiracy.
Right.
You know, we understand well, of course, there is a lot of damage taking place to Ukraine. The people there are undergoing a lot of suffering, and the war must end. There must be a ceasefire. There must be a peaceful resolution. All that said, we do not ignore the fact that geopolitics is at work there, and India cannot take a partisan view of it. So this is what you have said is in terms of the overarching essence of it, which is about Eurasian integration, about multipolarity, and so on. But these underlying templates are also affecting the Indian attitudes profoundly at this point in time.
Okay, Mr. Ambassador, I think you mentioned some very interesting things. First of all, I think you pointed to an issue which is good that we don't forget, which is that during the crisis, during the epidemic, the coronavirus and the COVID crisis, a lot of countries came to see who their real friends are and who it is that will really help them. And unfortunately for India, we really saw that the West was not really that helpful in many ways. And so this is one interesting point, and I think that may be a factor in the thinking that is now happening maybe in India in terms of who can they really trust. And of course, you mentioned the very long and important strategic connection that India has had with Russia, so this is very important. You mentioned strategic autonomy, which I think is a key concept, because most countries want to have that, actually. Most countries would prefer to be able to make their own choices in terms of where they want to go. And I think that's maybe a good way of understanding why India is doing the things that it is doing, as opposed to maybe the West, because they are used to using and instrumentalizing other countries. They might say things like wedge, or using India as a wedge, or using India as a tool against Eurasian integration. But if we look at it from the Indian perspective, it is more about strategic autonomy and having choices, that India has certain choices. But the issue is this, because you said that the foreign policy should be based on national interests and those things that should be the basis of it. So is it really the case that, you know, India and, for example, China, because you mentioned Russia, we will put that aside now for a second because it's clear what the relationship is. But maybe the thing that the West is particularly worried about is China. So what, in your opinion, is it really the case that China and India are rivals? Or is this something that's said and propagated that is more to the benefit of the West to keep this alive? Is it a myth? Is it a reality? And considering how things have changed very rapidly, both internally in China and globally, and also in India, is it really the case that India has to look at China as a rival as a potential enemy, that then it needs to have sort of some relations with other countries in terms of trying to, you know, keep that autonomy vis-a-vis China and Eurasian integration, as we talked about it?
Well, you know, here I must qualify right at the beginning that I'm not articulating the official viewpoint.
Of course. Yes.
I'm explaining to you how I tend to see the paradigm.
Yes.
Here, the first point is the American factor, which you have said right in the beginning. The American factor has been there right from the time of India's independence. In fact, you know, the American interference in Tibet. In the early 1950s,
correct.
From that time onward, America had an axe to grind. in India's India-China relationship. Even before the border dispute flared up, the conflict ensued, the war ensued in 1962. The relationship sharply nosedived and assumed adversarial overtones and prompted both countries, not only India, even China, both countries to realign. We're keeping this in view, this troubled relationship in view, to derive advantages out of it. And it has a whole history after that. You know, you must remember also that almost up to 1980s, the two countries were in their comprehensive national power, were more or less equals.
Right.
And then China started galloping away.
Yes. You know,
so see the that is also an added factor. Now today, for example, when you ask a question whether India regards China as a rival, I don't think so, because Indians are realists, and we are talking about a country which is 5 to 6 times bigger than India in its GDP.
Right.
And, you know, there's no point, it's senseless to speak about rivalry here. It's more to be understood, more to be analyzed in terms of coming to terms with realities. The border problem is virtually, to my mind, intractable. More than anything else, due to the fact that public opinions have hardened.
Right.
The two countries have entrenched narratives, and a course correction in policy itself is difficult because these narratives also have to be reworked. And
correct.
It's easier said than done.
Is there a place, excuse me, Mr. Ambassador, just a brief question here. Do you think there might be a place for a third party to come and try to resolve these issues? Because it seems to me that maybe if this issue is resolved, there might not be other major issues. I may be wrong. That this issue is being weaponized by those who really don't want some sort of an alignment or some sort of good relations, strategic relations between China and India. Of course, they do have good relations, but it's always this thing in the background, as you called it, intractable and you know, very little space to give on either side. So maybe there's room for a third party to come in to try to resolve this. What do you think?
Neither side is inclined to think in that direction, neither China nor India.
Mm-hmm.
They would like to handle this themselves,
right,
bilaterally.
Correct.
And India, of course, has a very consistent view that its differences with other countries, neighboring countries, should be bilaterally resolved. And because, you see, India's history shows that interference from outside led to a loss of independence for India.
Correct.
Their colonial rule began in a very inconspicuous way as interference with one kingdom.
That's right.
In it, coupled with another kingdom. And then it just went on expanding. And
correct.
The external power came to dominate the whole subcontinent. You know, this is the history.
Correct.
So, you know, I don't think India is looking for a mediation, or India will ever think on those lines. But coming back to what I said, you know, let me mention this, that the resolution of the border dispute is not something that I envisage, you know. It needs a complete change of mind. It's too idealistic to imagine that any leadership in India or China can easily do that. Maybe China, it's easier, but in India, it is far more difficult to do that. Because it means, you know, that a certain entrenched opinion, its entrenched perspective, mindset has to be obliterated first, you know. So you see, what is possible, therefore, realistically, is to ensure that there is peace and tranquility on the border.
Correct.
And that has to be worked out. And I think that is what both sides are reconciled to. Now, the American thing, coming back to it, they have used this opportunity. This is a window of opportunity to interfere. Firstly, in terms of, you know, the fact that, you know, they always cure the pitch. Whenever, you know, an India-China event threatens, from their point of view, threatens, quote-unquote, to take a positive direction, you will find, you know, planted stories in the media and American think tanks and everyone getting into the act.
Exactly.
Press ahead with the thesis that China has evil intentions.
Do they have partners for that in India? Are there people in India who... Yes.
He's not alone in that. You know, this is the tragedy of most countries, including, in my opinion, part of this problem in Ukraine is self-invited
exactly.
by Russia, partly because of this reason. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union itself
yes.
is to be attributed to a certain degree to this, you know, that
yes.
there is... We have these Westernist camps in our, and most of them are playing, you know, their own games and their own interest groups, basically. You
yes.
know, so that is there, but that can be disregarded, you know, beyond a point. We don't have to attribute a larger than life influence to that constituency, but the American factor remains, you know, that they want to interfere because. You know, they also get out of this a lot of benefits out of this. India's defense preparedness, its requirement for advanced weapons. Now, there is a multi-billion dollar American interest in that.
Correct.
In selling weaponry to India.
Yes.
So you see this tension, keeping alive this tension. There was a time during the Cold War period, the United States used to do that also to India-Pakistan relationship, you know.
Yes.
And United States is involved itself in creating misunderstanding between India and Iran.
Of course.
You know, right from day one.
Yes.
So, you know, this is an American lifestyle, you know, of American diplomacy.
Yes.
So they do that. But having said that, you know, I must acknowledge that it's a complicated relationship. And these incidents which took place on the border 2 years ago have had a traumatizing effect on the Indian mind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So things have calmed down, but, you know, the good things are also there in the sense that trade between the two countries is flourishing.
Yes.
Well, now coming to my viewpoint is this, that, you know, that this is essentially, this is a byproduct of the history, you know,
mm-hmm.
modern history,
yes.
the border dispute and all this. And therefore, setting aside this, when I mentioned at the beginning about our national priority, we must work on that at the moment, because there's a lot that India can get. India can be a
yes.
beneficiary by working with China.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.